Hello and welcome to the Logia Books podcast. We are Logia Books. Today we're going to do things a little bit differently than we have been thus far. Basically, me, Amina Waya, and him, Fori Banu, are going to discuss our short stories that are going to be featured in the soon-to-be-published. Well, at this point, it's already published.
Yeah, but by the time this comes
by out. By the time this comes out, it will be published. Some stories, short story collection, or short story anthology on the Logia Books bookshop. It features my work, Corey's work, the work of two other phenomenal female writers, Jia Wong and Akudo Chukuma. So let's discuss.
Okay, so I guess some stories is just part of what our Logia publishing focuses. We're looking for new and exciting writers who are genre agnostic. We want high quality literature of all kinds, and some stories are just a showcase for the kind of writers that we are sort of speaking to and we know about and we're discovering along the journey, and it's just a showcase for that thing. But also not just as a, it's not a filler, it's not like bad content for good aims. It's actually stories that we have loved, grown to love, and want to push out there in the world. And and short stories are always a good pointer to the kind of artist that emerges from that subspace. Yeah, if you can write a novel, you can probably write a good short story, I suspect. And the length of the story doesn't, it's not a determining factor. Some of the best writers only write short stories, and some of the best writers don't write short stories at all, but probably could.
Yeah,
I remember there's this funny quote by Soyinka, as reported by Chinua Achebe. And you know, that's the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost. If you had Hemingway and Joyce, but I don't know where to put those ones. So let's say four of them hold three positions. Anyway, Chinua Achebe once said, I think it was a preface to his own short story collection, about how Soyinka told him once that you have an unrelieved competence in short stories. And first of all, Soyinka phrasing anything is fantastic. So that was fantastic phrasing. So yeah. I used to go around telling people, you have an unrelieved competence in something, then add blank. But so yeah. So in that sense, that's what some stories is, showing all our unrelieved competences in that particular format.
Fantastically put. And you will actually see a little bit of that in the other episodes we've already released from this podcast series, the Some Stories podcast series, where we've spoken to the other writers, because both of them were very clear on, you know, this we've done these short stories and they're great and we've enjoyed it and it's fun, but we also have other work that we have either done before or things that we are planning to do or to release. And like, so you realize that this isn't a one-trick pony kind of thing, or as Foru said, this isn't just bad content for good purpose. These are people who are writers. No other description for it. They're just writers. And this is one of the many things that they are able to do with that gift and that talent. So let's talk about our work in some stories.
Okay. So Spite. No. Breathing House first, right?
Okay.
Is Breathing House and Spite?
Yes.
Okay, so Breathing House, what was the idea that launched that story?
So ironically, the other day I was thinking about The Birthing House, and I was thinking, this is probably one of my favorite things I've written to date. And the idea of what launched The Birthing House for me was really just motherhood. I was in a place in my journey of motherhood where I was feeling very overwhelmed by all the demands of being a mother. Not because anything, basically, like there was no grand or dramatic thing that was happening. I think there's every mother, or maybe not every mother, but at least a lot of women I know, if they've been honest with you, will tell you that there is a part of motherhood, especially when your kids are relatively young, and my kids are quite close in age. There's a part of motherhood where you start to feel like everything is a bit monotonous. Everything is just dragging along, and your life seems to have sort of folded into these other creatures' lives, and you don't particularly feel like you are existing much outside of that. So that was a strong inspiration for why I decided to write that story in two ways. The first way being that specific, you know, the thought of feeling that way inspiring the story, and the second way being the thought of feeling that way making me feel like, oh, you need to do something. Like, you need to do anything. And writing has always been, you know, the thing that I've always felt the most good at. And I hadn't written it for a long time at that point. And I was struggling to write. You know, I was one of those writers who felt like, oh, I can write novels, but I can't write short stories, which is ironic because I'd only ever finished writing one novel. And I was struggling to finish any of like the other longer pieces of work I wanted to get started. All my works in progress were really just in progress and not going anywhere. So I decided to try to write a condensed piece of work, which has always been a struggle for me. And somehow did that successfully, both with Spite and with The Birthing House, but specifically The Birthing House, because of just how much it meant to me at that point to write about motherhood and mothering and to create this world where it's not particularly, I'm not going to go as far as saying it's all so different from the world we live in now, because it's not particularly that different. The language of that world just frames the real experiences of real life mothers in a different way. So it's not very different. It's a different language to describe things that a lot of people are already familiar with. I want to ask you about The Fable. Because I honestly, more than anything else, and I love that story, but more than anything else, I love that it's described as a fable. And I wanted to hear your thoughts about why you chose to describe it as that.
Okay, because I think the first book that came out is 8 years, and 8 years is very earthy and based in our reality or recent history.
Mm.
But that's not the kind of writer I am at the end of the day. I think I'm more metaphysical and than in my concerns than that book would allow. And the idea of a fable is always that you are seeking truth by a certain aesthetic. And I thought that was the idea. And that was the strongest idea I had when I finished it, that I'm trying to say something about the nature of reality. And it has to come in the fable because I don't want to be bound by just what we know. The idea that our reality is just through our five senses is ridiculous, obviously, because we're limited by our five senses. We're not elevated by them in that sense. We're only able to see as far or feel as close or taste or hear or any of the other things. And so that is, fables are good to sort of break through that and create more senses in terms of how you perceive something that is deep or meaningful to you. And that's what that story was. It was just, oh yeah, I want to play with that meta aspect of the idea of literature, the idea of story, the idea of character, the idea of creative and creation, because the biggest question of existence is, where do we come from? And then where are we going? And so in that sense, it has all those elements, I think, inside it.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's beyond the reach of our five senses, we can't tell with any certainty. It's a fable.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where that came from. So I'm still on Burton House because I remember reading an early copy of it and absolutely hated it. And I was like, what shit is this? I was like, maybe you should consider not writing it. I didn't say that or think it, but
you said that.
But I didn't mean it. I said it like a come on. You don't waste your time with this. Don't go hard or go home. I think that was my major point. I could have been kinder. We're younger now, marriage. So, but I mean, just to show how that turned out. When I read the second, I was like, oh, okay, yeah, you remember. You remember, which is weird because I never, like, I'm completely like, oh, no, any art of value, don't do it. But when I read it, I was like, no, I know you too much. Keep quiet. I'll tell you that this is fine. This is not fine at all. You need to throw the story away because I remember even the story annoyed me. It was simple, like, but when I read it again, I was like, oh, no, it's actually quite brilliant. And I got everything from a second stab at it. So what changed between the first one and the second one? I guess is the meandering question I'm asking.
No, you know, I feel like anybody from the outside looking in and hearing this part of this conversation is going to think, why is he so horrible? This, that, and the other. But like you said, we're early in our marriage. We have the kind of relationship where I would believe if you told me something I was doing wasn't up to scratch. I trust that you're doing it for the very best reasons and you have no ill intent, and vice versa. But when you told me, when I sent, and the thing is, the first draft of the birthing house, and I've said this to you before, I had a teacher or a lecturer who used to tell us, don't ever let anybody see your first draft.
Yeah.
And she wasn't like a creative writing. She was just like, you know, she was trying to talk to us about essays, and she said, don't let anybody see, you know, all your grammatical errors or the thing, like your incomplete thoughts and all of that. And that was what that first draft was. I, of course, felt comfortable sharing it with you because it's you. But the reality is it was a very incomplete thought. I had a general sense of what I wanted to say, specifically centered around, because the birthing houses are almost characters themselves in the story. So it was really centered around the character of those homes. And I knew the general sense of the story I wanted to tell based around that. I just hadn't developed it. I wasn't seeing the characters. I hadn't sort of delved into the depths of the story in a way where I could write it. And I was still struggling with the form. I was still struggling with the idea of a short story and how to write a condensed story where it still makes like coherent sense. And it's still a full story, but it doesn't need to be, you know, the length of a novel or a novella or anything like that. So the shortest things I'd written at that point were poetry. So I didn't really, you know, understand the form just yet. And all my past attempts at writing in that form had failed rather miserably. So that was, I think, like, those were the big, big differences between that first. By the time, like, having that conversation with you, as upsetting as it was at the time, because I was like, you have no idea how many, like, I'm fucking trying. The kids are like, because, you know, it was at a time where I was home more than you were. So I was feeling very hard done by, and I think every married couple has probably gone through this, where you're like, he gets to go out and talk to adults and have a life. And I'm here with the children and I am trying to write something. And this is for me to be like supportive is like, this is shit. And I'm like, well, even if it is, it was just not a great like mental space for me. So I had to like sit away from like my feelings about that and be like, no, but he knows you. He was one of the first people to read your book, your completed book, and tell you how fantastic it was and how you have your own voice and all of those things. You know that he has no, like, meanness to what he's saying. So what is the issue? And I had to sit down with it after, like, dealing with my feelings about the feedback and be like, oh, okay, so the issue is you've not really, you know, figured out the story in this format and you've not really gotten to the end of where you need to get to for this to be a completed piece of work yet. You let him see your first draft. So once I got past like that hurdle, and I really didn't think I was going to go back to it because the feedback was so bad, but once I got past that hurdle, it really just poured out of me and it worked so much better like the second go around. So yeah, I'm really glad that you gave me that feedback because it was the kick in the butt that I needed. It's honestly informed the way I've written since then. To the point where, like, I'm doing things, like, I'll write something just to, like, get it out of my system and be like, this is terrible, and just delete it. Like, I don't need to... No, it really has given me the confidence to just be like, you know your work and this is not your work, and then just to move on from it. So I'm really thankful for that feedback and for the story in general. And that's probably why it's one of my favorite things I've written.
And to defend myself, you are equally...
Scathing?
Scathing. When you think... I don't know how to tell that you'll be like, nah, that's not it. And you and Hector give, like, vague... Like... You don't give me any specifics. Like, I remember finishing a version of Goffy and I thought, I'm done. I sent it to Hector, which was before I met you.
Yeah.
And he wrote back and said, this is not it. That was the sentence. This is not it. And I called him and I opened it. And I was like, oh, open up. I was like, no, tell me what he said. No. You sound offended. I don't mean to offend you. But I'm telling you that this is not the book you're supposed to write. So, or how you would read it. I don't think even the books, more like the short stories, you'd be like, yeah, you haven't got it yet.
Yes.
Like, what yet? You'd be like, no, you don't have it. You know when you have it. What kind of esoteric short is this? Or editing idiot and saying, oh God, you're terrible. Why? Where is your grammar? Why don't you? I mean, I have a whole plan for ETS Volume 2 where to make sure I don't get as much insults in the editing as I did for this one. Like, there's a whole book in your email that you refuse to look at because of ETS. The whole next book. Okay. So it's not like I'm slapping you around. It's like it's a boxing match.
To be fair, that book in my email is not because of ETS. ETS drained me. Because that book, it's 900 odd pages long. And I think I was really scathing about it because there's nothing wrong with the story. It's a fantastic story. I think I was more scathing because of the volume.
Yeah.
It's one of the biggest things I've ever had to edit. So it was just like behemoth of a task.
But we were learning how to do it. There's no template for that kind of book for us anyway. And maybe there's a book like that somewhere in the world that I've never read, but by the next go around, I think we'll have a system in place. And it's so not like anything I've written outside that.
Yes.
It's not my style, it's not my, but it was just, you know, the impending one. The thing that I had to do at that moment, that's also. And we had a short
turnaround
to get it out there. So any mistakes you see, man, keep it to yourself. We don't care, don't write, don't email. Don't suggest just. We don't care. Take it like that.
The thing is that now that we're, it's one of those things where when you're in the work, you're like exhausted by the work. But once we did all of that and we got through it, I was reading that book in marvel. It was such a beautiful piece of work. So I think that, like you say, it's a boxing match. That happens with us when we read the first draft and we're like, not that. You go back and you work on it again and you send it to the person and you're like, okay, so is it this? And the person's like, finally, it's this. And so I think it's just one of those things. But yeah, it's always a pleasure.
Yeah. So Spite. I think I rate Spite on the same level as Fractures, the upcoming novel. I think those are the two, like, I mean, Breton Houses, they're all great work. But Spite is right neck and neck with Fractures, which I think it's a book. Because I think you have this unique ability to cross-culture, to, like, almost book code switch into places. I don't think I could read, and that's what writing is to me. Anyone I read, Hemingway, Joyce, Soyinka Achebe, anyone that transports me, Oakley, that transports me from a place that I've never thought of into, and somehow plausible. To me, that's the height of writing. And that's achieved in Spite, because when you told me the story, you told me the story before you wrote it, I was like, that's horrible. It's not going to go well. In my mind, I just said it. I just barely survived better. I must say the word about this. So I'm like, this is going to be, because you told me the whole story. I was like, first of all, I said, why? You were like, I don't know. I was like, no, I'm serious, but why? You were like, I have no idea. I was like, no. I mean, why? What is the point of this story? You were like, no, I just write it. I was like, but I said, okay. Then I remember I was traveling when I read it. I was in the lounge about to travel out on work. And I sat down in the lounge and opened it. And the airport and read it, and I sat down. And I think I had like a 4-hour wait. I think I spent 3.5 hours thinking about that book. I read it all over again and thinking, what the? How did he achieve this thing? So maybe that's my question. How did you achieve that sense of, because there's all of every character is empathetic.
Yes.
Only one character is truly innocent. And it ends horribly. Let me just tell you now, it's spoiler alert, it ends quite terribly in terms of the action, not in terms of the execution of the work, but it's still somehow beautiful in life affirming, even in that sense. I mean, there's the part where the thing happens.
Yes.
And I'm really, and the tears in my eyes, because I'm like, that's beautiful. Even though it's violent and sick and twisted, but God, that's some beautiful writing. So yeah. What's that about? What's up with that?
What shit is this? It's so odd that we're talking about Spite in this way, because, I mean, there's a lot of I don't know for me in Spite. I will talk about how it came to me in terms of, like, where the inspiration came from. It was at a time in my life where we didn't even know. We've known about doing Logia books for a long, long time. We just didn't know when it was going to happen. So, obviously, in the meantime, you do whatever else it is that you're doing with your life. And I've always been subscribed to a lot of writing stuff, and there was a call for submissions. The theme of it was Spite, ironically. And I was writing for that specific submission. No real intent, because I've written for submission. More often than not, writing for submissions for me is a writing prompt more than it is, an active attempt to be published by whoever is putting out the call. Sometimes I need inspiration and the inspiration comes from there. Very rarely, but this is one of the times when it was really successful for me. So I wrote based on that prompt, and I called it Spite out of just pure laziness at the time. And I thought, oh, maybe I'll come up with a different title for it. But like, by the time I was done, it felt so apt, I decided not to change it. But the whole actual unraveling of the story and how it became what it is, I could not tell you where that came from. The best I can guess is, you know, parenthood again came into play. And, you know, just thoughts of the extent you will go to as a parent, I guess is the best way to describe it. I find it equally horrible.
Mm-hmm.
There were points when I was writing it when I stood up from my desk.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I can think of the specific points now, not the one you were talking about, but the one that came before, where I was writing and I saw it coming paragraphs ahead. And I kept thinking, just don't do this. Like, don't go down this road. And then I did. And finished writing it. And it was so upsetting and so emotional that I stood up from the desk and, like, walked away from it for a bit. Because I just thought, this is just horrid. Like, so when I'd gone through a lot of those emotions by the time I was telling you about the story. So when you're asking me, like, why, I was like, look, your guess is as good as mine. I don't have a why. I'm not sure how. I don't know what's going on. The characters led and I followed.
Yeah.
I don't particularly have, like, a response for that. And I could ask you the same question about Sins of the World, because Sins of the World, by the way, is very, very beautiful.
Mm.
It's not in any way the same level of horrible as Fight, but it's one of those stories where you read it and you're like, no, but tell me why.
Oh, first of all, I've always read about angels for some reason. Like, I don't know. I had the thing when I was a kid that I don't want to get into, but it just gave me this interesting. It even made me watch City of Angels intently.
Don't.
It says, no.
Don't.
Watch Wings of Desire, the film it's based on. Don't watch City of Angels.
Okay.
It's absolute nonsense.
No, you could have left that last part out.
But yeah, but I wanted to tell a story like that. And there's a couple of short stories I have that follow that theme. And I don't know if I'm going to ever collect them into one and just, you know, I've invented a fictional character that I interact with on a purely psychotic level, I guess. So I was thinking of that, and I was thinking of things like Sin Eaters and Weight of Sin and those sort of things we grew up with in church. But on a more realistic level of the embrace of it and not the repulsion of it, because we think of sin as repulsion, but I wanted to take the other tact and think of it as embrace. Like, okay, so this is what all of the world is. And if there is a counterpoint to sin, it's not trying to hate sinners. It's trying to eliminate the negative effect of it, I guess. Which this is superficial, because I'm sounding like I'm speaking about something religious. And when you read it, you know this is not particularly religious. So let me not hype it like I'm like it's a Christian story, because it's really not. But yeah, so that's where the idea came from. And from that, I just built out characters. For some reason, I enjoy writing female characters more than I enjoy writing male characters. I don't know why, but I just find women more interesting than men. Maybe because I know what it is to be a man, I guess. Or I know men. I've spent many times with males. So I've listened to them in their smoky rooms and listen to all the nonsense or toxicity that comes out of our mouths. But with women, I'm always imagining, why did they do that? Every time, like, why? Because there's this thing where, because I've been more male in my interactions, I can tell where the stupidity starts or where it stops. Like, I can tell, okay, yeah, you were stupid here, and then you were stupid here, and you were stupid here, and stupid here. I would, with most of my female friends and acquaintances, I would be like, wise. Oh, they're stupid. Where did we move? How did we get here? What happened there? But even that is a superficial description. The long and short answer is I have no idea. I just had all these things in my head and I started writing it. And the more I wrote it, best kind of writing for me is when I don't know where I'm starting and where I'm going for. I remember there's a whole book I wrote in which Nasra said something like, start the book with I am God and then go from there. And I didn't know. I was writing a book for months, not knowing what in God's name was happening. So I'd write it and be like, the frame was there, the bones were there, the story on substance today adding itself. By the time I was done, I was like, oh, okay. So that's where I was going. That kind of writing always interests me more than, you know, the more stylized or planned out, framed out stuff. And that's where I think I like to operate more in not knowing the beginning from the end. So Sins of the World was just one of those things where I didn't know the beginning from the end. Sometimes it's in that moment I realize, oh, okay, this is about vampires, or oh, this is about ghosts, or oh, this is about angels. It doesn't occur. So I can't really say that's where that stuff came from. So there's a central tragedy in Spite that is troubling, to say the least. What would you say? Is there a purpose to the story? Or is it just to explain a tragic event in a way in which tragedy is the evil and not the people? Because I think that's what that story has. That no, nobody is evil here. But the event was tragic. And everybody had sort of has their flaw in that, how that came. But nobody intended that outcome. So you can't blame them for the outcome, particularly. Because it's not an act of their will. It's just an act of, it's just a thing that happened. So is tragedy the villain in your story? Or is there something else that you're trying to say?
No, I mean, I think you more or less hit the nail on the head on that one, because tragedy is very much the villain. I think outside of Fractures, I really, and Fractures, even that, I don't want to, you know, do too much to influence how people interpret what they're reading, because it's up to you what interpretation you take away from anything I write, to be honest. I write what I think at the time. I have written stuff and gone back and my interpretation of it has changed upon rereading the things that I wrote. So I try not to give too much credence to, you know, what, the death of the author and all of that. But yeah, I tend to leave villainy for concepts rather than characters. So in Spite, tragedy would be, you know, like you say, the villain. And I think it was more, in a way, to do with the tragedy of living. And I say that to mean a lot of the sort of subliminal thought I was going through at the time of writing Spite was about how, and, you know, this is not to get, again, this is not to get mad religious or anything like that, but there is a way that as a human being, you see people exist in the world and see tragedy after tragedy befall them, or you yourself go through a lot of loss and experience all of that, and it all feels for naught in a way, which is what I mean by the tragedy of living. The, I guess you can say, central character in Spite starts rough and ends rough. It's basically a journey through a specific arc of someone's life, watching sort of life happen, as it were, and our reactions as human beings to when life happens to us. I've always quite enjoyed, and that's probably one of the things that's intrigued me about writing for all of my life, I've always quite enjoyed watching people move through life, navigate the world and living, and see how they react to things that just happen. Because a lot of the world is just happening more often than not. You are on this train and you get off at the end, and while you're on it, you know, you're going high and going low and hitting the brakes and hitting the bumps, and that's just what it is. And that sounds very, you know, fatalistic. I'm not, you know, trying to depress anybody on a wonderful afternoon or anything like that. But that's, for my writing, not so much for my living, that's sort of how I approach characters. Sometimes I will put a person in a room or in a place and see how they navigate the world just being in this place. It's like putting someone in a fire and say, okay, so then what do you do? Do you stop, drop and roll? Do you start panicking and screaming and trying to say, like, what kind of character are you? And so it was really an exploration of that, and tragedy became the villain in that way, because if someone is just minding their business and thing after thing happens to them, as much as we want to lay blame at the foot of someone and say, you did this to this person or you did that to cause this, the reality is this person was just going along their way and they've been hit left, right, and center by just things happening. And how are they going to deal with that? So, yeah, in a way, I guess tragedy would be the villain. I was thinking about your stories in general, those we're discussing here and the ones that we're not discussing at all. You have a knack for creating these characters who are deeply wounded. And similar to what I was just saying, are just existing in the world with these open wounds. How and why do you do that?
That's a deep and interesting question. Because I think everybody is deeply wounded.
Yeah.
So we're just better at hiding. So the more interesting character, because art is about honesty. And the art that interests me is about raw and unfiltered honesty. So I create those characters because I'm trying to get at that part of life. And I always want to meet them at the point where they are aware of their wounds and they are fighting. Because to me, that's bravery. That's Hemingway's Grace Under Pressure. That's what it is to be. It's the idea that you are fighting against your programming. You are pushing up against your wounded nature. And you're like a wounded animal in a cage, but you can't, you don't give in to the, and this runs through, there's a song called Song of Zula that I heard years ago. And there's a part about where he's singing like a trapped animal. And he says, I would kill you, my bare hands, if I could reach you. And that's human nature. That's the other side of it, that raw thing that exists, that is, it is to be human, no matter what you believe. The idea that at any point, if you had the strength or the reach, you would rip another human being in desperation for your wounds. And that's how people get into it. That's how there's all of this stuff in the world, in a very simplistic way. So wounded characters are my favorite kind of characters because I think that's what it is to be human, because that is what differentiates us from everything else, that we can be wounded, not just physically, but emotionally and spiritually and inside ourselves. As far as we know, as far as we can and can communicate it. So it's possible, it's very possible that animals have emotional layers to them too. And you can see maybe in the more domesticated ones like cats and dogs and the rest, you see sadness, you see depression, you see all those things. But our unique ability to understand our own from common language and getting back to a place where we can translate languages across cultures and then understand, oh yes, this person, this a thing called depression, and even though we live on different continents separated by oceans and all of that, we can still feel the same way. And someone can jump off a bridge here, and some, to be, not to be morbid, and someone can jump off a bridge here, and everyone is wounded. And I find that innately human and beautiful, regardless of outcome. So I always start thinking I'm going to do a good ending, and then it never works out because the wounded creature will not end well in a present sense. That's why wounded characters, I'm guessing.
You know, it's ironic you're talking about the good ending, because I remember us having this conversation about endings, and I said I think all my endings are good, and you were not on board with that analysis.
I do not remember a single good ending. Maybe Breton House, but Breton House, I'm not sure that she doesn't compromise. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, not to add any spoilers, but I'm not sure that end is not, that her true being is completely inside that end. Do you understand? And the same thing with Fractures, and I mean, despite you don't have to even, that's not an end in which anybody would be inspired by to go out and do good works. Early on, I would swear, okay, I'm going to end this in a bit, but people come wounded and leave wounded. My stories, I'm not particularly sure. Okay, maybe there's one or two, because I'm not nihilistic. I'm particularly not agnostic. I'm not in any way, in terms of my belief system, promoting the idea that life is pointless and all is going to end bad. I don't think that at all. I think there's a beautiful light that we're all going to walk into at the end of all of this. But I'm rarely speaking of that in the immediate stories. I'm speaking of the thing in between and how we're coping with the mess that we're in now. And that's in the third world country is easier because you see wounds everywhere. And they're physical and emotional and financial and all those things. In the first world country, it's just like, you know, we speak about the Nordic or Scandinavian countries and the high per capita and the also high suicide rates and all those things because the human soul is wounded. There's no money doesn't fill it. Jobs don't fill it. Purpose for might feel for a while, but either the great tragedy or purpose is you achieve it or you don't achieve it. Either way, you're still wounded by it. So yeah, so that's the whole thing. So it's a good ending in general, but I don't know that good ending. All I know is the thing that I'm seeing in front of me, and that is what I think art should represent. Finding beautiful ways to describe the thing that is happening to all of us.
So this is why I will insist on arguing that my endings are good. I think of my endings as a purification by blood and fire.
Okay.
I don't think that a painful ending is not in itself a good ending.
Well, it's not a good ending. Because good means... And I don't mean good in any, like, in any metaphoric sense. I mean good as in a good, like, a romantic comedy ending. Like, Matthew McConaughey and Kate Hudson end up together. Yeah? Do you understand that? Or Banky W and whoever the girl was in Up North end up together. Do you understand that? They end up together. I have no idea. But I'm assuming they do because it's supposed to be a fun movie. But I mean that kind of ending, that everything is resolved, everything is good. The traditional difference between tragedy and comedy in the Shakespearean sense that a Macbeth is a tragedy and As You Like It is As You Like It even a comedy. I would think, I'm trying to think of the comedies. Twelfth Night. So Twelfth Night is good because it ends, everything's solved, I suppose. But The Tempest, as opposed to Hamlet, Macbeth, and Richard III, which are basically tragedies. So that's the definition I'm using. I'm not using it like in terms of, oh, it's beautiful, because all of it is beautiful. But you know, you cannot argue that at the last moment where that thing is happening, in spite that that's a good ending. It's beautiful,
yeah.
But it's not a good ending. It's definitely a comedy in the Shakespearean sense.
I mean, look. I'm just dark of soul because I was like, my book is not a bad ending. Everything was as it was supposed to be. All pieces fell into their place. And isn't that in itself good?
Yes, like endless compromise that she's going to have to make an ending breath now. So she can exist in a society that has left feeling behind. And focused on purpose as an ending itself. So it's beautiful to consider. But I remember the first time I finished Breathing House, my problem with it was almost like Black Mirror. I was like, yeah, this is a Black Mirror episode gone off. And I people said, I haven't really seen this episode, haven't they done something like this with Black Mirror? And I realized, no, actually, it's really not anything like it, especially in its final version. So, yeah.
It's possible that there is a Black Mirror episode like this. I wouldn't put it back, but
I've seen every Black Mirror episode that there is, even the bad ones. I can assure you, like, I'm losing a new bad ones. But yeah, anything, because Black Mirror has sort of like copyrighted dystopia on television. So everything seems like, even that other one, I think it was called Electric Dreams, that was more like the Philip K. Dick thing.
Yeah.
But Black Mirror takes so much from the Philip K. Dick atmosphere that, you know, it's anything that came after that was trying to copy, that was trying to show, and those were his original stories.
Yes.
But it doesn't look like Black Mirror because Black Mirror did it first. So, anyway, that's a detour into television nonsense. So, yes.
So, on that note, the usual spiel, we are Logia Books. You can find us on www.logiabooks.ng. You can also find us on social media at Logia Books. We are on Twitter, which is now called X for reasons that we cannot understand, express, or explain. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads, and YouTube as well. So yeah, we are everywhere that you may be, and Some Stories is out now, available for purchase. Also, 8 Years by Fori Samson Banu, who was joining me on this podcast, is also out on our online bookstore. The ebook's out on our bookstore. So please indulge copiously. And we will see you next time. Thank you.
Bye.